Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Arlene Cohen.
You're listening to the midweek version of the Fiber Talk podcast for people who do the needlework thing.
Yes, the needlework thing.
A brief plug for that Dayton, Ohio chapter of the Embroiderers Guild, their 2019 symposium, The Work of Our Hands Then and Now, is April 10 in Kettering, Ohio. And a whole list of things going on. Kathleen Staples will give three lectures on in the morning, and they have some afternoon events. And just if you're in the area or can get there, probably worth the time, I think.
Yes.
Actually, have given some thought to making the drive. So anyway, we have a link on the page for this podcast, ega-dayton.webs.com. And there's a link there for the Dayton Symposium. You can sign up for that April 10. So that sounds like a good one. It looks like they put together a real nice package of history and modern day things. Plus, that physical therapist and occupational therapist team that's going to talk about Stitch Without a Glitch.
Yeah. I mean, I love the description for all of that. That's the kind, the history, the connections. That's the kind of event I would love to, you know, spirit myself through time and space and just be able to arrive without any, you know, travel difficulties whatsoever. If I could get myself there, you know?
Road trip, Arlene, sleep in the car, you know.
I love when I get opportunities for, history, lectures, conversations, topics of all that kind when it comes to, you know, expanding horizons of needlework. I think it's fascinating.
Well, but that's, you've built your whole design effort. I mean, I think I can safely say that a vast majority of your design effort stems from your interest in historical needlework and historical art in general. I mean, that's where you get a lot of your inspiration. I know you Winterthur and several things. You are a frequent participant, but you've derived an awful lot out of the historical art for your needlework and used it to great advantage. So that's what I always think is fun about your stuff, is there's always a story behind something.
well, thank you. And I like to share that story, and that's why I love when I'm looking at designers' patterns of any type of needlework. And when you hear or read, you know, whatever if there is a piece shared of, here was what the inspiration for this design or where this design came from. I love knowing those things. And sometimes either that piece isn't shared or there really isn't an interesting story, and I accept that. but it's why I've always tried to share the stories. And especially when there's like a history behind it, which, you know, I think we can all learn a lot from, especially the things that are forgotten from history that maybe, you know, need to kind of circle back and come back and be shared, because there's so much amazingness, especially within the art world, from our historical past. So why not bring it back and see it with fresh eyes?
Yeah, no, I definitely. I mean, I've learned a lot about some stuff I'd never have heard of if it hadn't been for you. So I've always enjoyed the background that goes into your pieces, because I learn more than just here's another design. So yeah, that's great. We're a couple weeks away from the Nashville show. So I'm looking forward to that. Doing some videos and showing what new people have. So watch for that. I'll be posting those. We'll have links at wetalkfiber.com, and if you're a subscriber, you'll get notification as we post them. But then also on our YouTube channel, our FlossTube channel, we'll have the videos. So I'll be doing video tours of the various new designs, and now that I know the lay of the land of that show, really looking forward to tackling it in a different way. So it should be fun. Gossamer lace. Now, yes, you finish that monstrosity, and you turn right around and you're doing it again in cross stitch. What's wrong with you? What is wrong with you?
Wrong with me? It's I'm not going to 100% say, well, that was the vision all along. It was, I was hoping that I would want to start stitching. I mean, I love the design of it. It just, you know, it appeals to me. And in particular, I had found the perfect thread to do what I wanted to do. And, you know, to, you know, checking off all the boxes here, I wanted to show, and I shared this with in my recent floss tube video, that it is my plan in what I shared, that I'm not planning to stitch the full cross stitch design. I am planning to stitch parts of it. And that's partially because I don't think I have it in me to stitch the whole thing. I have other things on the deck that I want to be stitching. But it's also because I want to show how, well, this design in particular, but lots of other designs, mine as well as others, you know, you can get so much out of stitching part of a design, and just to show what that could look like, you know, and that, so some of it is like the fun challenge of doing that. And again, there, so it's all the pieces. It was finding a thread that was just going to work perfectly, sort of the reverse colors of fabric and thread from what I did with the black work version, showing that pieces of a design can work beautifully on their own. And, you know, one thing I have learned about myself as a stitcher is I do enjoy, I don't want to use the word jumping, but that's what it is. When I finish one style of something, in this case, a big project on black work, I do want to go to a different medium. I did, you know, I wouldn't want to do a big black work piece and then jump to another big black work piece, you know,
yeah.
You know, moving on to a cross stitch piece is what was the right thing to do. And maybe after a cross stitch piece to work on an embroidery piece or a canvas work piece. I mean, I tend to kind of rotate in that kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when you see a design, I don't know, I think a lot of the Quaker samplers, Quaker, those designs with a lot of the Quaker motifs, you see a number of designs that are out there that have these individual motifs that have been put together. Some of them are like reproduction sampler, Quaker samplers, and some of them are not. And sometimes it's very easy to say, oh, yes, I could take that particular part right there and I'll stitch it as a small for an exchange at a retreat, or I'll take that small, that part, and stitch it as an ornament for my tree. But sometimes you lose that. You can't see it as well when it's not as obvious that you could take just a part of it.
Right.
And so part of my thinking was, well, you can do that with this. This is a circular design. And so what I'm stitching on it right now is literally just the first few circles. yeah. So that's what I'm doing.
Well, Curdy Biggs, who was on a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about several of her designs, and she was pointing out how that same kind of thing, that mm-hmm. the way she builds her designs, often with a central dominant piece, and then radiates out from that. But she was talking about how her pieces could easily be portions taken out and made into ornaments. And it gets back to that, how you can get so much more out of a chart than just doing the, you know, the design that's on the cover. And
yes.
just a little bit of vision. And like that gossamer lace, I mean, I've looked at that more than once in terms of, you could take a couple of portions, a couple of segments, and make a piece out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And piece them together. And as you've mentioned, stitch just the center section.
Mm-hmm.
and make a very nice design. Just stop there. And I think that's, when it comes to any charted piece, that there really is a lot of opportunity to pull out and make ornaments, or just make a simple, another design, a small item, a little stand up or something, without and just, you know, change your threads and go for it, and maybe add a little extra border on it or something. But any number of things that can be done. And I don't think people mind those charts as much as they should.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I do a complimentary thing. I do the main thing, and then I could have four portions as little side frames or something. And
yeah. No, there's so many options out there. And
so what's the difference? Black, the same design, black work versus cross stitch. Is cross stitch faster?
No, at least for what I'm doing, I am going to declare the black work was faster.
Okay.
And again, just the reminder that the black work version is not reversible. If I had been taking the time to do that black work in a reversible, meaning back, like if I turned the back over and it's identical to the front, that kind of black work, that would have taken much longer because you would have had to like plan stitching paths and do some more starting and stopping. And I so was not doing that. If it's going to be framed, which it will be, there's no point, you know, go ahead, do what you need to do. So from that perspective, the black work was definitely quicker to stitch. And you know, I guess that makes sense if you think about back stitching. Well, I don't know. I guess everyone has their own opinions about back stitching. I don't mind back stitching at all. I've certainly learned from FlossTube there are some people that will stay away from it with a 10-foot pole. I don't know, if you're just doing outlines of something, which the gossamer lace is, you know, if you take a flower and if you think about the black work version of it was like the outline of the flower, whereas now the cross stitch version is filling in that flower with X's, not outlining it, just filling it in with X's. Filling it in with X's is going to take longer than just outlining it. Makes sense?
And that makes sense. But then the reason I asked the question is, If you're a regular cross stitcher, you can trot right along making X's. So, you know, it almost becomes a second nature thing. So then does that happen here where if you don't do a lot of black work, you have to think about what you're doing and pay attention more. And so I just wondered if you found that you could just trot along faster making X's, but it sounds like not.
No, because the black work here is really no different than the running stitch back stitching that you might do within a cross stitch design. And there's not really, I'm going to say it, additional thinking involved. It's again, because I'm not trying to make it reversible. I'm not trying to plan out a stitching path that will keep it reversible. That's where I think black work can have significant time involved. But this piece was not in any way designed to be like that. So that's why I would say the black work version for me, and I mean, for anyone who's familiar and comfortable with back stitching in general, I would go ahead and say for anyone, the black work version would be quicker to stitch. But I don't know. We could have a little timed contest, I suppose. At some point.
No, it just seemed like there might be a surprise in there, but apparently not. No. And that whole backstitching thing, not my favorite thing, in a cross stitch piece, but I don't think anyone would ever dispute that once you do the backstitching, it adds such dimension to any cross stitch piece that you almost kick yourself for not wanting to do it. But it's the old. It always equates to me from when I was first learning needlepoint and I would stitch the design and then have to go back and do all the background in basket weave and just shoot me. Just, you know, I've thrown away several projects where they're all done except for the basket weave background in this, you know, cream or pale blue or just some painfully boring thing and back stitching. And so it is the same thing, and it comes down to it, you know, there's two camps. Do I backstitch as I go, or do I save it all till the end? And I do it as I go because I hate it. So
I think you have to. Now I've never really done a, well, now I'm saying this, I'm pausing to myself. I think you have to kind of set up, all right, I need to put in two lengths of backstitching before I can start moving on something else. So like, you know, you have to kind of set up a reward system for yourself. I'm not allowed to start that flower or that house or that bird or whatever until I, or when I finish this bird before I can start the next thing, two lengths of backstitch or whatever. That's one mindset. And then the other thing I'm thinking about, which, so again, it's going to be different for every person, is when I was working on the silk gauze piece that I did on Needlepoint Nation, sort of the first place you kind of found me.
Yes.
And there are areas of that that were solid color, sort of the equivalent of the background. Now, granted, the whole thing is done in 10 stitch basket weave, what have you. But there were certain areas that were just solid, quote, background color versus all the flowers and filigree and other designing things. And there were parts of that where I was kind of playing that game of, okay, I just finished that flower. Now I have to put in a length of blue before I can start the next thing. But I will say there were also plenty of times where, you know, it had been a long day. And I was so glad to just have a night's worth of stitching where all I had to do was fill in the blue area. I did not have to look at the graph. I did not have to contemplate changing colors. I didn't have to count. I knew this area had to be filled in with blue. That's what I was doing. So it was actually nice to have those options available at times.
Mm-hmm.
Or there were areas that were blue, and then there were other background areas that were like in a crew. So those two background areas were really helpful to have. So, you know, there's ways to kind of play the mind games with yourself when it comes to that kind of background stitching, whatever it is, whether it be a counted needlepoint on linen, what have you, that when you need to fill in that background stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot to be said for those evenings.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Just mindless. Just let everything just kind of flow out of you. And
And you don't have to do any counting. You don't have to refer to the chart. You're just.
Can't screw it up. Yep. Can't miscount. Yep.
This area has to get filled in with this color. Go for however long my eyes can stay open.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. A lot to be said for that. Yep. Yeah. Maybe that's what I should have done.
Yeah, not thrown away those pieces.
Yeah, I kept them for those evenings. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ah, oh, well. They're gone. Oh, well. Mm-hmm. All right, so you've had a little run with DMC needles, which I have found interesting on several fronts.
Mm-hmm.
But when you first posted the thing, and you'll have to tell the story.
I will.
Because
yep.
You did tell it on your floss tube.
Yep.
My first reaction was, and this is, it's interesting to me. My first reaction was almost to pick up the phone and call you and say, Arlene, quit buying cheap needles. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. Can I make that statement? Do I know for a fact that DMC needles are cheap needles? And I could not, I've never owned any, so I really couldn't say, but based on the picture you put up there, they sure looked like they needed another step in manufacturing. I think I even commented, it looked like you could saw wood with those things.
Wow.
So I had to stop myself and I had to stop myself from saying, don't buy cheap needles. 'Cause I wasn't sure that was the case, but, it's just been an interesting little experience you had there.
So let me recount the story. So I started with posting some pictures on my Instagram, and then I did share kind of the full story on my recent floss tube. So a few weeks back, I was at a Michael's and needed to pick up, among some other things, some needles. My general philosophy when it has come to needles for my stitching, I am fully aware and very much respect that there are some people that feel a difference with different kinds of needles, that their hands, whether it be oils or acids or whatever it is, that they know that their hands like strip something on needles, that they're very sensitive to. I get that. I respect that. That said, I have never found those issues to be true for me. For me, I have just stitched with whatever needles have been in front of me. There have been times where I have picked up, you know, a good selection of needles when I've been at an L&S, and I've used those packages, and then that package runs out, and wherever I am next and I need to pick up needles, I get them. And the truth is, if I am taking out the last, I'm going to say size 28 from a package, and I go to look and realize, I don't have any more packages, I try to think, all right, I don't want to get in the position of losing this last needle and not being able. So I think, when will I have the opportunity to get another package? So in a situation, something like this, I was thinking, I'm going to be at Michael's soon, get some needles. The DMC needles that are sold at your Michael's, at your Joann's, at your big box stores have always worked for me. They may not work for everybody. They've worked for me. So that particular day, I'm at this Michael's. I pull a package off the rack, and it just caught my eye that the package sitting right behind it was not the same. I mean, it's packaged the same, but I was looking closely. The eye of the needle, one of them had a smaller eye than the other. One of them was a package of five. One of them was a package of six. The packaging looked identical, but the needles were different. And then I proceeded to look at the whole rack of them. I think there were eight or nine, and literally about half were one kind and half were the other kind. And it satisfied one thing to me, which was I was pretty sure at some point I had been stitching using a package of 28s that had small eyes. And I remember thinking, eyes should not be this small on tapestry needles. These are the size eyes that you see on embroidery needles, which have a sharp point. What's wrong? Why is this like this? But never like really pursuing it enough.
Yeah.
But then I think the next package or the next time, or maybe I then got up and saw, well, I have a package with bigger. I didn't pursue it at the time. But here I was in the store and I saw the two packages with the two different eyes. So I bought both, came home, posted a picture about it. You know, what's going on with these? In that whole process, actually dug out another package. I mean, the truth was, and I knew this, it wasn't really my last 28. I had a package within my stitching, like my carrying stuff, and I didn't want to use up all those needles. But it was a package that had been bought within the last year, probably last spring. And those needles were even different. So I had three different kinds of needles that had been packaged, DMC needles. The older package looked more like the ones I was used to seeing in terms of their length. They were longer than these two packages I'd recently purchased. And the eye was more like the longer eye that I would traditionally see tapestry needles. I happened to be at my local needlework store. I picked up from them a package of John James needles and Bohin, however you pronounce it, needles, just so that I could compare all these needles for length, for eyes. And then I also had Pat's golden needle, Pat's.
Yeah, I've never actually used one of those. Some people swear by them, though.
Yes, the eye part is a gold color. And I actually, after this whole DMC discovery at Michael's, I switched over to using the Pat's needle specifically to see, okay, is this going to feel any different to me? Again, to me, I wasn't feeling anything different. Were the DMC needles like shredding my thread, shredding my fabric, any of those kinds of trying to be very observant and feeling that, I I wasn't encountering that. I had one friend comment to me about this. She said she used – actually, it's the same – she said she used to use DMCs and then she started using others. And she said after she started using others for a significant amount of time, when she picked up a DMC needle, then she could see the difference or feel the difference. Wow. So that's interesting, is that if I am using any of these others for a significant amount of time and then try picking up one of the DMCs, will it feel different to me? I don't know. Again, I feel like there have been times I've used others just because it's what I had, and then I ran out or lost or broke, and then I started using a DMC. And again, I feel like I try to be very observant and very sensitive, but for me, I haven't noticed a difference. So it's been a very interesting saga of the different needles, that DMC has, same package, different needles. They clearly must have like a different source or different something out there. If you are somebody who's using DMC needles, you may discover, as I have, that the ones that at least I currently am seeing in stores are shorter than previous Tapestry needles. And this is size 28. I actually have not checked what the other, you know, what I could say about 26s or 24s, but the size 28s are clearly shorter, and some of them have smaller eyes. When I say smaller eyes, it's like an embroidery size eye, embroidery needle size eye. Some of them are more tapestry size eye.
Yeah.
So my needle saga has been an interesting experience.
Yeah. Well, clearly the DMC people have a quality control problem somewhere.
Yes.
Because each packet should have the same, I don't care what style or type of needle it is, each packet should have the same of all the, you know, all the needles should be the same.
Yes. I tried, I did, just for my own curiosity, reach out to customer service. I was trying to bring that to their attention. I don't quite know if my message got across. but yes, no, I agree with you. Whatever they want to call size 28 tapestry needles, separate from comparing it to any other brands, whatever they want to call it, they should all be the same.
Right.
Or they're going to switch over whatever they're going to call it. You should not have two different kinds being sold at the same time over a length of period of time, whatever.
Yes.
I don't think my message completely got through. Whatever.
You tried.
I tried. Yeah. I tried. So.
Well, and that, you know, I just bought a couple of packages. Bowen is the needle I tend to use, though I have some tulip needles. Thank you, Mary Corbett. I really like a lot.
And I was thinking about you, and I know that you had talked about these tulips, and talk to me about, how would you describe the difference between stitching with a tulip versus others? Because my LNS also sells tulips. I bought the other two. I didn't buy the tulip. I wasn't ready to make that leap yet in my whole needle experiment. But how would you?
Yeah, well, they're certainly more expensive.
Yes, yeah.
I struggle with it. The needle thing is interesting because I think probably, if we knew the truth, 90% of it is just personal opinion, and there's really no basis.
And personal opinion is fine.
Yeah, yes. And it would not surprise me one day to learn that John James Bowen and Tulip are all made in the same factory on the same line. They just, at one end, you know, at the end, they're just split off and put in different packages. You know, it wouldn't surprise me a lick. But I do believe that the Tulip needles are smoother. They seem to flow better through the fabric, are smoother. I know I enjoy stitching with them more, but is there enough of a difference between that and the pile of Bowen needles that I have to be worth the extra money? I think I'd have a hard time making a case for it. 'Cause right now, working on the reproduction sampler, the Sarah Brazier, I'm using Bowen 28 needles, and I have a bunch of them because I keep different colors threaded up. Mm-hmm. And so I've got a bunch of them in play, and they're just fine. You know, I mean, that's the ones I've used all along. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, that's the thing is I think the reason I got them was I was buying needles. The first time I bought any needles, that's what was hanging on the rack in the store. And I bought them. And I tend to be a brand loyalist anyway. And I've just stuck with them because every package I get is, they're consistent.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's the most important thing is, am I getting every time what I expect? And that has been the case with Bowen. But then I have some John James needles, and I can't tell any difference between the two. But I think there is an extra level of finish and performance, if you can put performance on a needle. I don't know that you can. With the tulip needles, I think there's a little bit more, but is it worth the money? I'd be hard pressed to say, yeah, you got to go out and buy those. They're very nice. They're very nice, but yeah, they are more.
Now, but you did just say you really enjoyed stitching with them.
Yes.
What makes you say that? What makes it different than stitching with a Bowen?
I want to say flow. I just feel like they, and flow isn't a very good word for it. I just feel like they just move through the fabric nicer.
Okay.
It's just a feeling. I just feel like, and they feel good in my hand. Mm-hmm. I do like them. And then, I say that, but then when I'm working on this and I have some 28, no, I don't either. No, that's why I don't do it. I could not get size 28. Tulip needles. So that's why I'm stitching with Bowens. That's right. Or I would be stitching with tulip needles. I think I would. They just have a nicer feel to them. But could I stand in front of 30 people and say, you must buy these because they're three levels better and you're just going to love them? No, I can't make that case. No, no. And see, part of the problem is, like those kinds of things. Like I'm a real pen snob. Like you'll never see me hold a Bic pen unless, you know, I have no other option.
Okay.
I've got a, Margaret gave it to me 30 years ago, a Mont Blanc, fountain pen as an anniversary present that I still have today. Love that pen. I've always been that way, a pen snob. And I think some of that spills over to needles too, where I'm not sure a gain's a thing because a Bic pen works just as well, but, there's nothing like writing with that Mont Blanc fountain pen, you know, it's just the way I am. So I don't know. And that's why I say I gotta believe that when it comes to needles, 90% of it, maybe even more, is what's in your head. But then you make the case that what's our most important tool?
Our needles, yeah. Sure.
And so then why scrimp there? And in relative terms, they're cheap.
But it's also, actually, now that I'm saying this, I'm thinking it'd be kind of fun to set up a blind test, you know, with...
Yes.
Like I would need someone to set it up for me. I would set it up for someone else, you know, take a DMC, take them all, including DMC, take a tulip, you know, thread them all up, same color thread on the same scrap of fabric, you know, put in the same 10 stitches. Do you feel a difference? If so, what's your preferred? And then, you know, reveal needle C is this, needle A is this. And, you know, that would be a really interesting thing to do.
You know, if someone were to have an event, like say a retreat or something.
Yes.
There would be a group of stitchers of various experience levels. That might be a fun thing to do.
That could be an activity that could be planned. You know, we might need to look into this.
You'd have to have an event. I mean, you'd have to have an event for it, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like in August. But
maybe like the first weekend in August. Yeah, who knows?
We should do that. Let's do that.
All right. I will put it on the to-do list.
Let's do that.
And for people who are kind of clueless as to what Gary and I are talking about right now, there is a New Jersey floss tube retreat that I am running that Gary will be attending the first weekend of August. And this actually could be a really interesting little activity that,
let's do this. This, we got to do this now.
Yeah. Well, I'm still waiting on the, testing of threads, that are 20, 30 years old. And is there really a difference between,
I don't think that's going to happen. Yeah. I don't think you're going to get that. No.
Like but that. the needle thing.
Blind test. That would be fun.
Yeah.
Have to see. We got to do it. We got to do it.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. We'll make Bendy go first. Michelle's the first one.
All right.
We're doing the test and Michelle's first one. All right. That's it. That's how we kick it off. Yep.
Okay.
All right. Okay, so we have an activity for the retreat other than just stitching. Okay.
Oh, there will be activities, don't you?
All right, that's the deal. We have something. I think so.
All right.
Now, people have to, let's see, what do we got? Oh, we got plenty of time. We got all kinds of time. We got to do this thing here. This Angie Russell Hunt asked a question. And then we're going to talk about your tablecloth because I got to know about this tablecloth. So Angie Russell Hunt says, is there a trick similar to the pin stitch used for stitching confetti and cross stitch that will avoid shadows of threads when stitching a piece with a lot of back stitching of writing? I try not to carry from word to word, but stopping and starting each letter separately would be a pain. And so she put up a picture when she posted this of a piece that had a lengthy verse. And so I thought that was a legitimate question. I did not have an answer for her, but I said I would ask you and Vanna if you knew any tricks. Because my reaction is I would carry between letters because usually the distance isn't that far. But then I would end a thread after every word. Because there's usually more space between words. So that was the only thing I could offer. I don't know a trick, because sometimes you can get the thread to go at an angle where it's mostly hidden by ground cloth thread, but it doesn't always work that way.
Yeah. So for me, it all depends on how many fabric threads we're talking about. So, I mean, I suppose there might even be some spread out word that even going from letter to letter would be too many fabric threads for me. And on the flip side, there might be going from word to word where the words have actually been pretty close together that I'd be perfectly fine traveling. So it's all about how many fabric threads are we actually talking about here, whether I would make the judgment call of, yeah, I want to end this thread, or yeah, I'm okay with traveling. So that's like the first thing for me. I don't know anything I would call a trick. The only thing I would say is that I would completely avoid trying to travel completely horizontally. So if, for the sake of describing it, I just ended my last cross stitch, let's just say at the bottom of the X. So I'm at the bottom of this letter, the bottom. I would not want to, and I'm actually going to travel, whether it be to the next letter, to the next word, whatever. I would not start that next X at the bottom of the X, even if it's my natural inclination to always start, you know, bottom left to upper right or vice versa. Okay. Or bottom left to upper right or bottom right to upper left, whichever way you do it. If I just ended on a bottom, I would not start on a bottom. I would, for that next X, start on a upper part.
Yes.
So let's just say upper right. And so then the thread that's behind would by default go on an angle behind the fabric. As long as that angle is not a perfect 45 degree angle, which it wouldn't be if you were on an X that's on the same row. Am I saying this correctly?
Yes.
If you're on the same row, you're just going up, if you're doing it on linen, two fabric threads, you've got like this slope, I'm going to bring in a math term here. You've got this slope of, let's say, 3/1 or 4/2 or 3, whatever, that it's as good as you're going to get. And that's where you're making a judgment call. Are you okay with it? If you're stitching on a linen fabric where the fabric threads are kind of open weave, yeah, I wouldn't be doing it. If you're stitching on a fabric where the fabric threads are kind of tight, sure, I would probably do it. I would just make that, like, so the only thing I would do is make sure I would be going at an angle from that perspective.
Yeah, that, and I would agree with that 100%, because if you go straight across and start at the bottom, then your thread is just going to fill in behind all the openings in the cloth.
Correct.
And it'll be as obvious as day. But the minute you put any angle to it visually, even if you can see the thread, the carried thread, it gets broken up enough that it doesn't bother you near as much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it depends on the color of the thread.
Sure.
You know, if you're on an ecru or cream cloth and have a light colored thread, you can get away with more carry than obviously a dark one. You know, sometimes I'll be lazy and cheat that just because you can't really see it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, but I at the end words I would end. I would that just would be me. I would just end a word, but I wouldn't end in letters. But yeah, I would yeah I agree with you 100%. Find some way to get an angle to it as you carry that thread, because it busts it up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I find these little things. I guess that's what really gets my mind when I'm cross stitching, is those little things, the path you follow, where do I start the next X, mm-hmm. where am I going to end up, you know, when I get to the end here, am I going to end up such that I don't have to carry the thread any further than is necessary, because
mm-hmm.
I'll change, like at the end of a row, I'll change the way I make the X. Still the top always going in the same direction, but mm-hmm. I'll change it so that if I'm going up, I always end up at the top of the X where normally I might have been going to the bottom.
Yep.
All those little tiny things that I think make a difference. I don't know. In my mind, they make a difference. In my mind, they're worth the trouble.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Yeah. And can you, all right, now, like, for instance, I'm stitching a reproduction sampler on 40 count linen.
Mm-hmm.
And you can carry thread single, you know, one strand of silk over two on 40 count linen. You can carry threads because it's so dense, the ground cloth is so dense, you can get away with more carry still at an angle than you can, say, on a 30 or 32 or something like that. At least I've found that. But I it's been so long since I've used Aida. Does Aida give you more carry opportunity? Because of that filled in square?
My gut reaction is going to say yes. But again, I haven't. It's been a while since I've been on Aida. Or I feel like since I've been on like white Aida, I've been on dark Aida not that long ago.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I want to say because the square is filled in, you just got to avoid, you know, you're avoiding like half the holes or
right.
You start to have like half or even less than half the holes than you would in linen. So you have, there's less opportunities for anything to show through. So I would think that you don't even have to worry as much on Aida than you would on linen, I think.
Yeah, see, that would be my gut reaction too, and particularly now that some of these higher thread count Aida cloths, I mean, you can get them up in the 20s now. I got to believe that gives you some more flexibility that you wouldn't have with other cloths.
I would think so too.
Yeah. Because that I had to watch very carefully when I did the stocking I did for my son. I believe that was 28 count Lugana. Not sure I'll use 28 count Lugana again for a long time. Kind of a flimsy thread, but very open. And I had to really be careful with carries. I mean, the stitching was quite dense. It was a lot of solid fill. But when there wasn't there, I had to be really careful because that threat, if I carried much at all, it would show right through. And I remember at least two or three times going, "Oh, I can't let that go. I got to redo it some other way." Mm. And which becomes a pain because then you're stitching three or four X's and then ending a thread, and you know, it becomes a pain. But you know, the alternative is to carry, and then it really is distracting. So.
And this is the stocking that took 30 years. Am I correct?
Right, right. Well, and you know, and that's why it took so long. I was so meticulous, Arlene. You know, every stinking detail. No, never mind. It took that long because I kept putting it off. That's all that was.
Well, were you putting it off because you weren't enjoying the experience of it? I totally understand that.
Nah, it was raising kids.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right.
I got to... That's no excuse. That's just reality.
Right.
I was raising kids, and when you get to the stitching time in the evening, it's like, no. I'm going to fall asleep in the chair and then drag myself to bed.
Basket weave projects.
What's that?
That's when you needed your basket weave projects.
Yes. See, and they were in a box, and I didn't have the sense to use them. Yep. This is sad. This is so sad. Okay, so a few minutes left. I got to know this. Now we're going to do just like you do in your floss tubes. We're going to talk about lace at the end.
Okay.
So you were at this, tell the story, but you got this massive tablecloth.
Yes.
With lace and silk.
Yes.
That looks like every time you pick it up, you got to get the vacuum cleaner along with it. But
yeah. So, the story of this is that one thing that some lace makers do, I don't do it too much, is do demonstrations at various places. What is bobbin lace? And they're making lace. And one of the women in my lace group was doing a demonstration of bobbin lace, and a older couple were having a fascinating conversation with her. And the gentleman said, you know, my first wife collected a lot of this beautiful lace stuff. She passed away 25 years ago. I've had these boxes of her things. I just have never known what to do with them. Would you be interested in them? And this particular person, who's also a teacher, you know, really knows how to take care of good things. She's like, well, sure, my lace groups would love to see. And sure, there's always a chance when something like that happens, it could be a bunch of nothing.
Right.
But this gentleman brought in six full boxes. of some of the most amazing things. A lot of it was, and if I've got the story correct, it wasn't that his wife made lace. She just collected it. Some of it was handmade lace that I believe was purchased like on travels. Some of it was machine made, but some really fine, beautiful things. All kinds of stuff from small little samples to handkerchief with edgings, you know, edgings on handkerchiefs to just beautiful, beautiful things. The quote good stuff of this donation was used by a couple of the lace groups in New Jersey as to be put aside for like study use and display use. A number of the items were cleaned up and used for raffles at a recent lace day, which generates money, which helps brings in teachers and all kinds of, I mean, it's just such a wonderful donation. It's has been and is being used in a variety of ways. The things that just couldn't be used or couldn't easily be used in any good immediate way, the group had put out at their annual lace day, which was a few weeks ago. And I was aware of this whole scenario going on, and I knew they were going to have out the stuff basically on a freebie table, and I was told come early and bring a bag. So I came early and brought a bag, and you know, and again, there's if I was somebody like you hear about people who do crazy quilting and how they love to pick up, you know, lace bits and bobs and right. incorporate that and lace edgings, you know, so there was plenty of that kind of machine lacy stuff that I certainly hope a lot of it went to good homes. So, and there was some also large pieces of all kinds, but one thing that was this large piece that was in there And I, you know, found out more. One of the reasons that it was not taken out and cleaned up and put in the raffle, because a lot of the other large, beautiful from a lace perspective, because the lace on this is really nice. It's handmade lace. It's not machine. But it was not deemed worthy. They couldn't do anything with it, was because of the silk, the fabric of it, which is a silk. And the silk is just disintegrating, like the way old, old fabrics do. Like, and I was showing pictures and on my Instagram when I first got it. And then on my video, like even as I was holding it up, pieces are like flaking off. So however old that fabric is, it's just falling apart. And so there was nothing that they could do that they could like make it into a raffle item. And so it was in the freebie box. And I was looking at it. I'm like, what am I going to do with this thing? And at the same time, I was like, but if anyone's going to do anything with it, it's going to be somebody like me. And I just decided I needed to take it. And so I did. I took it. So I did get, it's something I should have said out loud, because a couple of people have commented to me, why did I think it was a tablecloth? Could it, because who would put something like that on a table and then put food on top of it? Which is a very good point. And so first of all, when I was talking to some of the lace people on that day, we were all talking about it as a tablecloth. When I opened it up, and I really only opened it up once to take pictures of it, because again, I got little silk scraps all over the place when I did it. It's about the dimensions, length versus width. Like, it just doesn't make sense as like a bed covering, which could be another item like that. But it doesn't, it's too long lengthwise for it to be like a bed covering. So tablecloth, but we're talking like a long tablecloth. So it's got a center, rectangle of lace. It's surrounded by a 7-inch wide piece of silk. Then it's wider than 7 inches, but like a strip of bobbin lace around that. Then another 7-inch wide of silk, and then a final edging of lace. It's stunning. It's dirty. It's old. If I were to do something with it, and I admit, as I said in my video, it was the more I've had it and the more I've thought about it, I just feel like I need to do something with it. And what something has to be involved, you know, step one, taking apart the lace from the silk. You could see it's been hand stitched. The silk to the lace is hand stitched. So cutting that off would be fairly easy. Washing the bobbin lace. I know from the woman who did most of the cleaning up of the items they put on raffle, what they did. And so I feel like I could give this a try. Whatever color it comes out. And again, I saw what they got. They got most of the things that were what I have, what I have now turned into a nice, we'll call it a soft ecru color. So, you know, a nice soft white, you know, ecruish color. And then some people have suggested to me, well, you know, you don't have to reassemble it. You could use the lace in other ways, which I could, sure. There's a side of me that would want to reassemble it just to have it as it was. I've poked around a little bit online to see if there's any place to find 7-inch wide fabric, 7-inch wide ribbon, 7-inch wide something, because what is on there now, it's not like it was fabric that was cut and hemmed or, you know, to be that wide. It's got a border to it. Like, you could see it was 7-inch wide. And you know, it would, it's quite an endeavor to do all of that, to reassemble it all, to do this whole project. But it just might be a project that I might have to do. I just don't know.
Well, I think it's fun. I think it's fun. Number one, I could just tell in your video, it's a gigantic piece of cloth lace thing, but to save it, you know, I can see why you wouldn't want to just let it go to the trash. You got to save it. Yep. And then you look at it as a tablecloth, but then now I wonder, when all the lace is removed and laid out and cleaned up and your wheels start spinning, if you don't start to come up with ideas that are not obvious to you now.
Sure, absolutely.
And then you had mentioned like there was some designs in there that you might make into a cross stitch piece or whatever. And I just, the part I enjoyed about it was the potential down the road from something that every time you pick up, you have to vacuum the floor. But the potential for other uses, repurposing in a very positive way. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's a ton of lace. Wow.
I was trying to approximate it because that picture that I showed where I had laid it on my bed and like it's so big. That was like the width. Like, I think the width of it is over 6 feet. And so the length of it is, what did I approximate it in my head? I want to say the length of it is easily 10 feet, if not more.
Yeah.
So I should have measured it when I had it open that one time and I didn't. Yeah. But it's easily 6 feet by 10 feet, if not bigger than that. So.
Yeah. I just think it's just when you talk about history and art and, you know, preserving these things, there's what can come out of that. It'll be interesting to see what you do. And you know, you may take it apart and put it away and not touch it for a long time. And then all of a sudden a light will come on and you'll take that out and do something with it. And I just think it's neat to be able to have an opportunity like that, no matter what it is, whether it's lace or needlework or whatever, to save it and maybe resurrect it or find another use for it, or just keep it just because of what it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a lot of lace, and all hand, and you can tell it's all handmade, huh?
Yeah. You can tell. Well, and actually, it's easy because it's not particularly fine threads. It's not like I also held up in my video a piece of black lace, and that had some fine threads, and that's why a few of us were kind of debating the thread. The lace in this is not. It's not super fine, so that makes it all the easier to determine that it is handmade, and that's just, it's amazing. It's just a huge amount of work that went into making that. Whoever did it, I mean, who knows what the backs? I mean, that's of course the missing piece. I just so wish I knew what the backstory of that is, you know, and how old is it? You know, how. That's an unknown piece as well. To say the silk is falling apart, well, who knows how old the fabric was when the fabric got attached to the lace to begin with, you know?
Yeah.
Who knows? So
It's just fun. It's, you know, one of those opportunities that you were smart enough to seize it and see what happens down the road. I think it's just fun to grab that stuff. Yep.
Oh, and that's, you know, for anyone out there who enjoys going to thrift stores or garage sales and stuff like that, it's that same thrill of the hunt. You just never know when you're going to come across a treasure. And this is that kind of situation of, I came across a treasure, and it is what I can do with it, what I will do with it. Will, you know, I'll keep everyone informed.
That'll just be fun to see. Just be fun to see. Yep. All right. We got to stop.
All right.
That's got to be it. Thanks, Arlene.
Always fun to chat with you. Thanks, Gary.
Same here. Quite frankly, at this juncture, I don't know who's coming up Sunday. I really just don't. It's either going to be Nicola Parkman or Sarah Rakestraw from Golden Hind Needle, Goldwork. Oh, man. But I don't know, really know, because I haven't recorded either one of them, and they're coming up. So it'll be a surprise on Sunday. Thanks for listening. Thanks, Arlene.
Take care.